Well, I said, so up to this point, we have covered a lot of Job all the way back in March. I believe it began. We began with those chapters 1 and 2 as God sitting upon his throne and the morning stars and the sons of God come before him and Satan with them as they wandered the earth. And God posed the question to Satan, had he considered his servant Job, who was blameless and upright, that there was none like him in all the land who was blameless, who fled from evil and feared the Lord. So that's where it began in chapters 1 and 2, as we saw God release him, release Job from the hedge of protection, as we discussed then, to be tested, to be tried, as God boldly spoke that he would not turn from him. And again, so all was taken from all his possessions. His children were taken from him. And then Satan came back to him and said, of course, anyone can lose everything, but if you touch his body, that'll do it. Then he will curse you and then he will die. And thus God released him once again. And then began the poems. Thus the poetry begins in chapter 3. So in chapter 3, after the friends see him, the friends come, Job opens his mouth after 7 days and releases a dirge unlike no other, a lament of sorrow and darkness. If you go back and read chapter 3, which we'll spend some time discussing as an overview tonight, he just mourns his entire existence and yearns that his birth had never taken place, cursing the day of his birth, cursing his conception, wishing that all that was light would become darkness. And he becomes enveloped in this theme of darkness and making all that is light dark around him. From there, we saw 4 through 27, the friends begin to speak in response to Job's suffering, in response to this verse or chapter in 3. They begin to respond, and of course, his suffering is due to his sin. They have proposed, for the only view they have of God is God only causes suffering to those who are evil and wicked. Therefore, Job must be evil and wicked in some way in their minds. That's how they viewed God. And so Job makes defenses on his integrity that none of these things are true. He is not wicked. He is not evil. He has not done sin in those ways that they have claimed. And thus begins the back and forth. The back and forth between him as he laments his suffering, as he laments their conversations, as he cries out to God, as he in some ways gets angry at God because he doesn't understand his suffering in a worldview that says only the sinful suffer. So over those 27 chapters, we begin to see this interplay. And then Job gives one final speech, the Psalm of Lament the Psalm of Wisdom comes into play in chapter 28, where the wisdom is uplifted, true wisdom is put and praised. And then Job leaves his final plea before God to answer him. He lays it out there in chapter 31, God, give me an answer, after laying out all that he has suffered. Elihu then enters the scene, Elihu speaks. Adam unpacked that over the last several weeks, the different views on Elihu as Elihu brought forth his interpretation of the events that had transpired, his view of God and how God works, and in that he rebukes Job. And then we turn to chapter 38. As God enters the scene, God takes the stage in full. And so there are many different interpretations when we get to chapter 38. There's many different ways that people approach God in chapter 38. The first thing is most people involving poetry comes the question is, what is tone? Okay, when you read the voice of God over these four chapters, to a degree, how you interpret God involves how you interpret his tone. Is God angry? Is God bitter? Is God being petty and condescending? Is God belittling an unworthy adversary? Is God righteously and graciously restoring through a gentle rebuke? All of these and more have been proposed. As you read anything on this, probably like if you've read anything growing up in high school, everyone did senior year high school literature class. Nothing like I had AP Lit, which was worse than anything ever. Or second year college, English Comp 2, where you got to pull out all the literature, like, let's talk about poems. There's nothing like poetry, as everyone comes up with a different view of what they think the tone is, and therefore how they interpret everything. And so a lot of that, based on who you read, as they put tone into the text, you begin to interpret God through those tones, through those lenses. What's interesting is every commentary that discusses it will put forth a tone and then this phrase. It doesn't really matter, which is interesting. Because what they'll go is there are many different tones, but what we see in the end is the revelation of God to one whom he should have never revealed himself to, or who was not worthy of his revelation. So no matter how you take his tone, you will see that what in the end happens is Job gets a revelation of God that he did not have before. That Job will gain wisdom, Job will gain knowledge, Job will regain his standing. So as I said, there are lots of ways the tone has been approached. There's lots of ways we can take it. As God speaking as a teacher, catechizing his pupil and the things that he should already know. This is the direction of which I will take in the text. Not seen as a harsh condemnation, but as a catechizing rebuke. You should know these things, but you don't. So I will instruct you once more in what you should have known. And all this leads to a variety of interpretations as tone gives way to interpretation. And so interpretations also vary in the idea of how is he instructing, what is he instructing? As we cover these four chapters, as Adam and myself look at it, one of the things that probably jumps off the page really quick, if you're familiar with this, is God doesn't really answer the question per se. For Job, in chapters 4 through 27, there's been an argument about justice. Where is justice? But what God doesn't deal with is where is justice. But what is very interesting is what God does deal with is the idea of his sovereignty, his control, his omnipotence, his omniscience, his ability to be all, in charge of all, governing all. And before that, he lays Job out. And as I will make a case, as Robert Alter, one of the guys that's greatly influenced my reading of this text, will point out, what we'll actually see is a lot of God interacting not with Job in 4 through 27, but with Job in chapter 3. Job's initial lament, Job's initial crying out to curse the day of his birth that it had never been, as he seeks to call for an end of the light and to sink himself into darkness. As Job 3 continually saw Job go deeper and deeper into himself. As you reread chapter 3, you see Job continue to enter into a conversation with himself about himself, cursing his life, all that he had become. He ceased to look beyond and only look internally. And so what we see is God, through this speech, begins to pull Job outside of himself, begin to critique Job's myopic view, so short-sighted view, and show him something far greater. Show him himself. And so as we turn to chapter 38, the very first thing we see, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said. Now, for many of us, maybe we just quickly glance over that and go straight to verse 2. What did he say? But I don't want to jump straight to verse 2. I want us to linger for a moment on verse 1, because there's something very important in verse 1. Something that maybe we'll quickly forget because we've been in the book so long. Who speaks? For it is a key that up until this point, this name has been amazingly absent from the lips of Job, Elihu, and his friends. The name Yahweh, Lord. In the entire poetry of the book, the covenantal loving name of God that is personal, Yahweh, Lord, was only seen in the original narrative of Yahweh and Satan speaking. That is where the personal name of God was seen. throughout the text, the poem, there's been this interplay of conversing about Elohim or El Shaddai. That is how he's been referred to by the friends. It's how Job has referred to God. Now, maybe for some you go, oh, that's just a textual thing. They use names that are different all the time. But again, when you're dealing with poetry, words have purpose. You don't just randomly throw a word in just because. You don't randomly just throw Yahweh out, especially in Hebrew writing, just because. It has an impact. It has a meaning. It has a relationship connotation to it. Especially in Hebrew poetry. The idea of Yahweh coming echoes us back even, or forward in his mind, it would echo us forward, depending on where we date it, to God showing up in the burning bush. Yahweh appears. I am sends you. The personal God is at work. He's not some distant deity. He is a personal, relational God whom Job has been continually crying out to. And so the first thing we rest in the Lord speaking in chapter or in verse 1 is the reality of a personal God. He is a personal God who loves his children. Again, he's the one who set forth Satan to test Job, to try him, to take all from him. And he did not leave his son alone, but came and spoke to him now in the whirlwind. Something that, as we have seen, God is under no obligation to do. Elihu said as much. God has already spoken to you. You suffered. There, God has spoken. What else do you want? That was Elihu's point. God doesn't owe you anything. You are suffering. That is your view of God. God is teaching you through your suffering. The end of Elihu's speech. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, abundant righteousness. He will not violate. We can't see him. We can't experience him. Just know that he is God and he is good. But God shows up. God speaks. But what's really amazing is God also, in speaking in a personal way, doesn't speak like the three friends had said. Because the three friends had said, we hope God shows up. But all three of their responses is so that you may be destroyed. Not the most loving approach. As Eliphaz, he speaks of the fact that I will seek God in chapter 5 and I will be vindicated. Bildad, if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely he will rouse himself and restore you into rightful greatness. Sure, you just keep pleading your case. God will show up eventually, maybe. In a very sarcastic tone, Bildad. And then Zophar. Oh, there's nothing like Zophar. Zophar. In all of his loving kindness. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Zophar's point is, I hope God shows up and he can beat you down even more than you already are. Loving, loving, kind friends. Really encouraging with the voice of God. And again, as we see when we get to chapter 42, they did not speak rightly of God or who God is, for they did not understand the relational nature of God. And so while God will say some hard things, they're not meant to crush and destroy Job, but to build him up, to teach him, to do what only he can do, and that's to enlighten him, to pull him out of darkness into the light. For his revelation is the answer to Job's petition, the answer to Job's prayer, to hear me. Job, throughout his speeches, continually called on God to answer him, to bring knowledge to him. And harshly, he says in chapter 31, the very last words of Job, oh, that I had one to hear me. Again, not the most humbling of prayers. And as we'll see, God will put him in his place for it, but not, as I said, as harsh as some may say. He longed for God to prove him right, to vindicate that he was not a sinner, and to bring him once again the relationship that he yearned for. So if we remember Job's final prayer that I preached on a few weeks ago, He longed that God would once again be his God and they would have the relationship they had before, and that he would be proven right that he was without sin in his suffering. And so in a few weeks, we'll dive deeper into that. But in this, we see the restoring of relationship, that God is speaking to Job. That God speaks to him, and God speaks to him in an awesome and majestic wonder of the whirlwind. Now, the whirlwind here, it's a term, sarah, in the Hebrew, which is actually used throughout Scripture, speaking of how God interacts. It has multiple avenues, as we've seen lots in the Hebrew of Job. It has lots of different ways that is used, thus making it even more interesting on how to interpret God in the whirlwind. For some aspects, it is seen as the judgment of God on people, as it is seen in the book of Zechariah. It's seen as protection for God's people and judgment against those who are opposed to him. So Zechariah 1 has this picture of God coming in the whirlwind to protect his and to destroy those who are against him. David in Psalm 18 shows it as a mighty revelation of God that is both vindicator and judge as he comes in the whirlwind. In the book of Kings, we see the same idea of the whirlwind is that which is before Elijah that takes him. Now, again, there are other parts of Scripture that the whirlwind interplay of God speaking the whirlwind isn't new. Job is not the only place that God speaks from the whirlwind. And so there's this interesting dynamic of what is God doing, but ultimately what God's doing is showing his majesty, showing his power, but all the more he doesn't cease by just showing himself in a whirlwind. He speaks, and what he speaks will speak wisdom to Job. He will speak to Job's darkness as the living God appears. The fuller revelation of himself to Job that Job has not seen. And so as we continue to dive into the text, we move through this. We move from God answering Job to the words that God says to Job. So as we move into verse 2, we see, who is it that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That's a fun phrase. Again, as we work through this, there's multiple interpretations of this verse as well. The overarching theme seems to land into the idea of who is this who speaks against the design of God without understanding it? That's ultimately the rough breakdown of the Hebrew based on the different ways people have broken it down. Is who darkens counsel? Who speaks against the counsel of God, the design of God, all that God is doing? As that is what we've seen Job do from the beginning when he cursed his own birth, when he spoke against his birth and against conception, against what God does. It's who is speaking against all that I do without understanding what I do? So that's where it begins. So that's what he has called Job to answer. He's calling Job out to answer that question. Why are you speaking from ignorance? Why are you not seeking me? So God calls him to give a defense. Now, what's interesting here, again, as Zophar had laid out, you are but a worm and are nothing to God, and he should just stamp you out as if you are nothing. God doesn't consider him a worm. The actual Hebrew working out here is he says, gird yourself up like a man. Dress for action like a man. I will question you and make it known. Prepare for action. I'm going to talk to you. The anticipation of the Hebrews, you will answer me. Of course, we know that's not going to happen. But there is the anticipation that he is actually calling Job to stand and deliver. Not to be put down and destroyed, but to stand up. Be a man. You want to grovel and get up. We're going to talk. And so he calls him to be a man. In chapter 3, Job lamented that he was a man. Cursed is the day that the man was declared, that a man was conceived. He hated the very fact of his birth in the midst of his suffering. Yet God goes, you are one. Get up. We're going to talk. So he doesn't treat him as if he's nothing. He treats him as one in need of instruction who has lost sight of the reality around him because he's become so consumed with himself. He forgot who he is in relation to his God. He forgot who his God was. as he got more and more consumed. So we will ask Job to give a defense. He'll ask Job to come and stand and answer. This beautiful poem begins to unravel all of Job's misconceptions and show Job the great grandeur that is God. He will reveal himself more deeply than Job could ever imagine. He will show him the realities of who he is. He will show him the beauty of being a created child of God. And so this is the backdrop that overshadows the chapter, that will overshadow the questions. I know we'll have a lot of questions that will flow from this, but those first three verses lay this opening foundation, the seeing God at work in this way. And that's already 20 minutes. Okay, so we're going. It's all good. So as we unpack the questions with three additional subpoints, we begin to see the Lord question Job in 4 through 41. He will now speak to Job in a series of questions that does not end. One after another, after another, after another. What's interesting is, again, not answering the where is justice, because that's not the question God is dealing with. And as we saw in chapters 1 and 2, that's not the question of the book. But whether do the righteous suffer? And if so, how? How should they endure? And so God will begin by unpacking the very essence. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? So he begins by asking Job the question of his own existence, of Job's own knowledge of existence. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. God gets a little cheeky here. It's fun. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the suns shouted for joy, or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out of the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling bands and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no further. And here shall your proud waves be stayed. The first question that underlines verses 2 through 11 is who or where were you? Where were you? And he lays before Job a series of questions about creation itself with the question of where were you? In this, he continually unpacks Job's own thoughts of cursing his own birth and the idea of you weren't even alive when I created this, and yet you complain about your birth. Using a different birth metaphor. As Job complains about the day of his conception, God speaks of the greatest conception of creation itself. Where were you when this happened? You must know. You seek to undo nature itself. Tell me, where were you when I made all that you see? You curse the day. You wish no one sang on the day of your birth. Tell me about the day when the heavens rung out over my creation. When the angels sung, the term morning stars meaning the angels. The angels sung over my creation. Why do you curse the singing of yours? Where were you? What are you complaining about? Or where were you when I shut in the seas with doors and burst forth its womb? The thick darkness and swaddling bands. He speaks of this creation and birth narrative, birth poetry. As he continually points out the fact that I have birthed this, I have made these things. Where were you? Job, in the dark night of the soul, lost sight of all that God was doing, only cared about himself, couldn't see what took place around him. And here God is to answer by questioning, asking a series of questions, catechizing his student with knowledge that he would no longer live in ignorance. So while Job was longing for the cries of his birth to be extinguished, God brings him to the reality of the joy sung over creation itself. Would you wish to extinguish that too? These questions continually bring Job's existence into the work of God, reminding Job of the reality of all that God has done, with the reality that, Job, you weren't there for any of it. You don't have sovereign control. You are not like me. And in that, he is bringing Job back to the realization that God does things differently. God is not like man. God acts differently. God's existence is beyond ours. He is the one who created all things. He is the one who created Job. He is the one who conceived Job and birthed Job from the womb. God is the one who did all of these things. So as Job is so sunk in on himself, God's bringing him out to see the world in a grander picture, to see what God is doing. He worried about God hedging him in. He goes, I hedge the waters in. The same Hebrew word that says here, most of our translations use the word limit or prescribe limits for, is actually the exact same Hebrew word for hedged in that Job talked about himself. Why does God hedge in my ways? In this text, God, he uses the same Hebrew. I hedged in the waters. Where were you to tell me what I can and cannot do? Did you hedge in the waters? Did you tell them where their limits were? And so in this rebuke through question, he's reminding him of who the true creator is. And reminding him of the reality that God was involved. He's showing Job that God was not absent, ultimately. You weren't there, I was. And so the inference from the text is that he was there on the day you lament. He was at work on the day you are lamenting. From 12 through 30, not only does he question where he was, he questions Job's ability to even understand it. This creation that you critique, this work of me that you condemn in some ways, do you even understand the words you're saying? Do you understand who I am and what I do? From 38, 12, it begins, have you commanded the morning since your days began? Cause the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth, that wicked be shaken from it. It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare it if you know all this. Declare it. Have you entered the storehouses of snow, or have you seen the storehouses of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the days of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain, and a way for the thunderbolts to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the ground sprout with grass? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. So God continues to lay forth to Job, explain to me creation itself then. You want to undo everything, you want to live in darkness, then explain creation itself that this may be possible. Can you explain the light and the darkness? Can you understand the darkness you wish to bring upon yourself? If you wish it, then explain it to me. And of course, Job's answer is, I can't. I don't. And in this, God continues to unpack the reality of the full expanse of God at work. He's continuing to reveal more and more of himself by questioning Job's ability to understand that which he does not know. For Job was ignorant, speaking in darkness. And so God is continually bringing the light to the questions, continually opening his eyes. Had you been around then, you would know. God is pressing Job to remember who is the Father of all creation, who brings for the world every day rain and snow, who makes trees fall in the woods where no man hears it, because they do make sound. Man is not the measure of all things, becomes his point, for I make rain in the deserts where no man are. It's not about you. God continually, by showing creation, goes, it's not just about you. There's more at play. I am more at work than you can begin to fathom. So he draws Job to consider creation, continually reminding him to look at the world around him. Do you even begin to understand it all? Can you understand it all? Can you fully comprehend how the world works? In every minute detail, and how in that work things are accomplished. When I put rain in the desert, can you explain why that happens? Can you see all of the pieces falling in line, how that affects 30 years from now, 40 years from now? Again, continually remind Job who is in control. And as he brings that forth in 31 through 41, it's that reality that, can you even really affect creation? Look at my creation. Can you even affect it? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Again, he's been crying out that darkness would surround him. So God, can you even cry to the heavens that water will kill you? You want darkness to cover your entire existence. You can't make the rain come from the sky. Can you send forth lightning that they may go and say, where, and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can tilt the waterskins to the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clouds stick fast together? Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in the thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? So ultimately, he concludes 38, and it continues into 39 a bit, by talking about just basic nature itself. Who can you provide for the raven? Can you provide for the lions? Can you really affect nature itself? And so he's beginning to critique Job's beginning laments, Job's beginning internal turmoil. And it's very important that this isn't, that we don't lose sight of what's going on. Now, it seems very harsh, and I would say it is a good teacher rebuking properly his students, but it's even more than that. As we've talked about, based on where you place the timetable of when Job is written, one of the things that I argued early on is Job lacks something that we all take for granted, the revelation of God. We take for granted in our day and age that at any point in time, we can pick up God's word. At any point, whatever is going through our lives, we can see, we can experience God's word and his revelation. We have Christ, the manifestation of everything that Job experiences. We have the greatest manifestation of the revelation of God known to man. And we take it for granted. And what God shows here is the miracle of his revelation. If we place Job roughly as the time that I had said earlier, in the time of the Edomites, while Israel was in captivity, or even the beginning of the law, they didn't have a full knowledge of God. Especially the Edomites. As we said, these would be Esau's descendants. They have limited knowledge of God, as we've seen, so they guessed at best how we think God works. And what God shows up here to do is go, you don't understand me. You're trying to. You're grasping at straws. And as we will see, the friends come up empty. And so God does the gracious thing that God does, and God reveals himself. He gives himself in a way to Job, by beginning to explain things that Job couldn't even begin to understand. And in that, awaken his mind to see through the darkness, to begin to come back into the light and see the greatness of God for who God is, as he who is sovereign and in control. And so he does that by first reminding him of nature, as Jesus does to us. When Jesus gives his Sermon on the Mount, he reminds them in the midst of their anxiety, or in the midst of their angstiness. He goes, consider the lilies of the field. Consider, who takes care of nature? Who feeds the birds? They don't worry. I've got this. God uses nature to remind us and to remind Job, I am in control. Stop thinking about yourselves and look beyond yourself. And when you look beyond yourself, you see how God is at work. So God does that here. Look to the lions are fed. The ravens have their fill. Because I am God. Stop worrying. Trust me. Trust in who I am. And so we experience the reality of God pointing us to nature and then pointing us to himself as God teaches us more about him, as he teaches us the reality of him being real. But more than that, he shows us the full revelation of himself, not in a whirlwind, but in a person. For God spoke to us in former days by the prophets and the law. But now he has revealed himself through his Son. He no longer speaks through the world when he spoke through his Son, Christ. He revealed himself fully, no longer veiled, but in full humanity and divinity. And Hebrews even says in chapter 5, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplication with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, there's a lot to unpack there. We're not going to spend time there. But the overarching theme, that in his suffering, he continued to reveal more of God to us. And in that, he obeyed God through suffering, that he may show us the reality of who God is. So the word of God has rebuked Job's inadequacy, and the word of Christ informs our inadequacies. For we are to trust God. As we see Job suffer and God questions him, we're struck by the reality that Job suffered in ignorance, while Christ suffered in full knowledge. The beauty of when we see Christ through the book of Job is that we see in each of these words, Job wondered why he suffered and had questions about suffering. Christ knew he would suffer and had no qualms about it, but did it willingly. The God who asked these questions to Job is the God who chose to suffer for us. Christ who said, have you commanded the morning since the days began? Christ said, yes. Christ would say yes to every single one of these questions. And he suffered anyways. He suffered for us. God himself suffered and died and rose and ascended for us to reveal God to us and to make a way that we may know him, experience him, love him, and through suffering, worship him more. Job 38. Questions, comments?